but I will go to the point of exhaustion where I get rid of all of that stuff, all of that noise. You're physically spent, you're emotionally spent. That's where the magic is. And that's where the ultra runners find magic, right? That's where we find our spirit, our soul, our dharma. It's so clear to us in those moments. And one of the things I'm talking about, one of the mysticism criteria I'm addressing, is that that reality is more real than our normal reality. We have created our realities. We can recreate them.
Hey, welcome back to the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast, where we talk about what it takes to go the distance in running and in life. I'm your host, Eric Dieter. I'm an ultramarathon runner and a mindset coach. When trail runners get together to run a few miles, we never know where the conversation is going to go. So if you're ready, let's get started. My guest this week is Gwen Zwicky. Gwen is a runner. She is a cyclist, more of a former cyclist now. She is an instructor at Louisiana State University and an author. She has a new book that has just been released called Ultra Running Mysticism, Mind, Body, Spirit, and the Sacredness of Overcoming Suffering. Now, overcoming suffering is a thing that a lot of us as ultramarathon runners know about. But maybe not all of us have had mystical experiences. But Gwen and I talk about the relationship between the mind, the body, and the spirit, and how that relates to mystical experiences, and how running is a part of that for a lot of ultra runners and a lot of cultures throughout history. It was a great conversation. Hope you enjoyed it. Here's my conversation with Gwen Zwicky. Well, I appreciate you, Gwen, being on the show.
Thank you for having me, Eric.
Yeah. Now, I heard you on another podcast, and you are an ultramarathon runner, and you're studying the relationship between that and mysticism.
That is correct.
And you're writing a book.
I am.
So I wanted to get into the mystical part of this in a little bit, but I do want to find out, usually what I try to ask is, how did you get started as a runner, and led you to ultramarathon running?
Well, I am not from Louisiana. I'm pretty much from everywhere. But I used to be a cyclist. But when I came to Louisiana, unfortunately, we have some really bad drivers here. And I just remember hearing so many stories on the news about bikers getting hit, cyclists getting hit. So I decided to run more. I just kind of traded sports, sort of. I started running, and just like everyone else, I gradually progressed from doing 5Ks, 10Ks, half marathons, marathons. And one time I was running, I was training with a friend who had run ultra marathons, and I thought he was absolutely crazy. And then I decided to try it, and now I'm hooked. I prefer that over road races. I just enjoy the community. I enjoy being on the trails. And that's what got me started, I think, 7 years ago. I've been doing this just over 7 years.
Okay, wow. So, and you're in Louisiana. So what is the terrain like there? From being in Kansas, I don't think I've ever been in Louisiana, except maybe the northern corner. So,
Actually one of the better, well, I shouldn't say better. It's different. There are hills there. So when you're up in the northern part of Louisiana, there are hills. In the southern part of Louisiana, very, very few. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of tree roots that are main obstacles. Okay. Because we have the real saturated soil and we're at sea level or below. So we have some different terrain. In West Louisiana, we do have some hilly areas. We tend to gravitate toward places with hills, as you can imagine, since there are so few here. Mm-hmm. But basically, we have a lot of humidity, a lot of greenery, but the humidity is a challenge. The tree roots are a challenge. We don't really have any other main obstacles. Water crossings can be a problem if there's a lot of rain, for instance. Mm-hmm. But there is some varied terrain depending on where you go. And so what we do is we like to travel.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I know in the summertime, people who are north, in the Midwest or north, complain about humidity, and every time I think about complaining about humidity, I think about people who are in Louisiana and Florida in the summer, and like, yeah, no, I don't. I really don't have anything to complain about.
Well, the good news is that when fall, the temperatures start dropping, which they're just starting to do right now, and the humidity gets a little less crazy, we run like rock stars. So used to training in the hard parts, and then it seems almost effortless after all of that. So
and then the winters, you could run pretty much year round.
All year.
Yeah.
All year.
Yeah. And we had, in the Midwest, some of the people up north, I mean, they have a very short running season, so they're running in the snow a lot. But, so what are some of the races? What's kind of your jam as far as distance that you like to go?
My jam is not hundreds.
Okay.
I did attempt one, and unfortunately that was one of those areas where there were a lot of hills, but there was a lot of flash flooding that occurred during some downpours, which in Louisiana, those downpours can flood things really quickly. My body felt good until I could not get up a very, very muddy hill. And that was right before mile 50 somewhere. I can't remember exactly where. I don't wear a watch, so I never really know. But what happened is because of all the water and the trails tend to expand because people are going around puddles. And before you knew it, it was just all a big wet mess. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't get up the hill and I got hypothermia. I eventually made it up the hill and I made it to the aid station and I sat almost in the fire for I don't know how long and I just could not warm up. I was shaking. I was shivering. I was almost vomiting. It was not pretty, but I will tell you, it took a lot of investment. And as you know, training for a distance like that is a tremendous commitment and I loved every minute of the journey. But I don't know that I want to commit that much time to training anymore. Mm-hmm. I love running a 50K, a 50 mile, and an occasional 100K. But I would say that probably I like to do a 50K every few months, every couple months, just because.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's a nice distance. I mean, 50K, it's something that's doable, mm-hmm. and comfort. You don't have quite the same. Kind of recovery time that you do when you have to have longer distances.
And that's a big deal for me because I like to run very, very regularly. Mm-hmm. It's my therapy. It's just one of those things that I really hold in very high regard. And if I ever get to a place where I'm injured and I can't run for a while or recovery, it takes too long, I feel it in every sense, physically, emotionally, spiritually, I need to be running. So if I feel like in any way that is not possible, it does throw off my balance. It's really important to me to have a very healthy balance of mind, body, spirit. And that is a priority over distance or anything else.
Mm-hmm. So as you kind of brought up the topic that piqued my interest about the mind, body, and spirit and connected to running. So how did you start linking that? What was kind of your first spark that made you think, oh, this is something I want to pursue to investigate?
Many, many years ago, I was teaching in Southwest Colorado in the mountains. And I remember being out and it was a kind of desert-like. I think we got a half inch more rain than would be considered desert. I don't remember the specifics, but I was on a very, very long hike with a friend, got very dehydrated and had a remarkable vision. And it was very warm that day and it was plain as day to me. And I knew there was something to that experience. I was, oh my goodness, it was about half a lifetime ago at least. And I just remember thinking that there was a lot to the idea of being, physically exhausted and maybe even just a little bit dehydrated, which now my research is validating all of that. Mm-hmm. But at the time I didn't know. I just knew it was an experience. So when I started cycling, I liked to do long distances then also. So I would have similar experiences. I stayed away from the dehydration, but I noticed that I would have some reactions with that also. So I knew there was something to the whole idea of endurance. I am not fast at anything, but I am very good at endurance. So I do gravitate toward endurance activities. So I guess my whole life, I've known there was something to it. And then one day I was running an ultra and I said, what is this? And I talked to people at the aid stations. What is this? What is this? Yeah, I know what you're talking about. And I know I can recognize it when somebody's having that experience, but I don't know what it is. And I had just started studying philosophy. I went back to graduate school to work on another graduate degree while I'm working full time. And I decided that's what I was going to pursue. And that's what I did. So I started looking into it, and philosophically and scientifically, I'm putting ideas together in this book, and I'm super excited about it.
Well, cool. You said you had a vision. Can you kind of describe what that kind of felt like or looked like?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I have always gravitated to Native American culture, particularly in the Southwest. Mm-hmm. I have always spent a lot of time in the high desert in Taos, in that area, Santa Fe. I have visited Taos and Santa Fe many times. I lived in Southwest Colorado, and those places are very sacred to me. And I could never really explain why, but I did have a wonderful opportunity to get to know some of the Pueblo Native Americans. And the vision that came to me is I saw a young girl lying on a rock, and she had been murdered. And she had an arrow going through her chest. And she had long braided dark hair. And I just remember looking at her, and she was about 12 or 13. And at that moment, it felt like she was my daughter in that moment. And what's really interesting about that is that years later, I was teaching in Green Bay, Wisconsin, which is where I'm from. And I was teaching, and I met a young Native American. She was Oneida, that looked exactly like that girl I had seen in my vision.
Wow.
And it was pretty overwhelming. That was many years later, but I remembered her very, very well. And she looked literally exactly like that vision I had. Now, I didn't know what that meant, of course. I still am not sure. Do we ever really know? But I knew there were some connections there worth exploring.
Well, did you talk to her? Did you?
Yes, I did. But she was very young at the time, and she was just interested in boys and all that kind of stuff. Just really didn't matter much to her at the time. And understandably.
Did you share your vision with her and did you say what you'd seen?
I did. Her younger sister was way more interested in all of that. Yeah. Yes, she was. But she thought it was cool. In fact, it was really funny. The girls, she and her younger sister, were staying at my house one night. I had a sleepover for the girls. We were having fun and just playing. And I was like an aunt to them. And we were watching Beetlejuice. And you know how they're all flying around at the end? And the little one said, Gwenny, can you do that with us? And for some reason, they just thought that somehow I had these magical powers that I could make them fly, which was actually kind of fun. And I said, maybe if you eat your vegetables, and I probably should have approached that more seriously. But, you know, I didn't at the time. But it's very interesting, the connection that I had with both of those girls.
Yeah. And that's interesting that you had somebody that you recognized later in life. I've talked to ultra runners who have had, you know, they call them hallucinations, in the middle of the night. And one lady, you know, said that she saw, seemed like a ghost, but very real, very real people. Have heard a lot of ultra runners say that. Do you think that's those, what people call hallucinations, are something more than just the mind? Or the
absolutely
brain?
Not a hallucination. Uh-huh. I do believe there's a difference between hallucinations and visions. Mm-hmm. I've been having visions my whole life. I can't explain to you why. I do know that, for instance, when a member of my extended family would die and I was little, my mother would come to me and say, okay, Uncle Bill just died. You might get a visitor tonight, because I was so used to coming to her and telling her about people I'd seen or ghosts I'd seen or whatever that I'd seen. And, I have since been studying a lot about energy. And as you know, energy is never born, nor does it ever die. And we are energy. In fact, we are 90% empty space.
Yes.
And so what does that tell you? I mean, there's so much going on that I don't understand. I'm not going to pretend to understand. And I'm certainly not going to dismiss things I don't understand. I know there's more to it than that. The experiences that I've had throughout my life have proven to me that there's more than that, that there's more to it than that. The things that I've seen that I can't explain, the things that I know that I can't explain, that visions that I've had that I can't explain. Sometimes I predict things that happen before they happen. Sometimes I don't. There's no rhyme or reason to it. But what I can say for sure is that I think being an empath definitely lends itself to those kinds of experiences. And I'm very empathic. And it's interesting because I teach at LSU and sometimes I have to work really hard to turn that off because when I'm in a classroom, I see things happening with students that I don't want to. And most recently, I can tell you just last week, I had a student who was getting up to give a speech. I had no idea what it was about. I don't know until they turn in their outlines. And I just looked at him and said, you know, he's going to be a phenomenal doctor. And I see some sort of mechanics involved in that. Like he's going to be doing some robotic surgery or something like that. And that's what his speech was about. And he said he wanted to be a doctor. And I told him about it afterward, not to the spiritual thing, but I said, you know what? You're going to be an awesome doctor. I can just tell. And so I'll approach it like that. Because I don't want anybody to be afraid of that. And unfortunately, we live in a society that is generally afraid of things they don't understand or they want to discount them because they don't understand. And I understand that because fear is a very strong motivator. But I don't come from a place of fear. I come from a place of love. And nothing I see is bad. Nothing that I believe in is bad. I create my own reality and my reality is beautiful. It's full of very positive things, negative people, toxins. It's just not allowed in my life.
That's good. So, I guess what would you, for somebody who is looking at this, or listening to this, what is, you kind of described what your visions are. What differentiates those from what runners experience as hallucinations?
I think that a lot of runner's hallucinations, I've had hallucinations, by the way.
So you can kind of, you know the difference when you're having a hallucination, you know, it's a hallucination when you're having a vision. And so, and your visions aren't necessarily then tied to running or
I've been meditating. Correct. I've been meditating my whole life. And I know that meditation through my research, does open up other parts of your brain that you're not used to using. And when you do that, you create a larger capacity to have experiences that are outside of what we would consider quote unquote normal. So we spend the majority of our time, all of us as humans, we spend the majority of our time using a part of our brain that is called the default mode network. And what that means is a very small part of our brain that is developed by the time we're about 9 years old, that has taught us our social identities and what to believe, we normally spend there, all of our time there. And so when you meditate, you're actually using other parts of your brain. And when you're ultra running, that active meditation, you're actually using other parts of your brain. Now, a hallucination is something that generally you know it's not real or it's not meaningful. You know, I volunteered in East Africa and I unfortunately got malaria and I remember the hallucinations I would have and they'd make me laugh. You know, when I was running a 50 miler in the sun, I remember one time seeing a hallucination and it literally made me laugh. When I have a vision, it's more meaningful. It doesn't make me laugh or it doesn't create any of that kind of superficial response. It's something much more meaningful than that. Does that mean that people might describe visions as hallucinations? Possibly. I would say that one of the best ways to distinguish is how meaningful was it to you? If it was meaningful, maybe it was a vision. If it wasn't, if it was just something in passing, like I saw a big bird in the path and in the trail. And I knew it wasn't real because there aren't those big birds in Louisiana. You know, I did see some in Africa, but I've not seen any here. And as far as I know, they don't exist, but they might, who knows? Regardless, I think that there's a meaning attached to a vision, whereas with hallucinations, not necessarily.
Yeah. And the people that who have described hallucinations that I've heard either, stories of, online or people, you know, that I've talked to, it's something that's out of place. A friend of mine, you know, on his 100, he saw a monkey in a tree in the night, you know, and he told his pacer, there's this monkey looking at me. And she had to say, no, it's nothing there.
Right.
Yeah. So, you talked about a little bit that you, we're interested in the soul as well as the spirit and the body, and that your research is kind of involved in that. So what is the relationship, I guess, between the three and in the mystical experience for ultra runners?
Wow, that's a really, really huge question.
Yeah, no, I know it's a huge question, but I guess the reason I ask this is that the mind and body and spirit is something that I have been interested in for a long time, and so I thought I'd just give you the whole. I would give you room to kind of talk about what you're.
Okay. Well, fair enough.
That was the reason I made it broad.
Well, as I interviewed you for my book, I was talking, and you were talking about the connection between mind and body and how they both work in tandem all the time. Mm-hmm. When we are feeling self-efficacy, which is a very normal thing for ultra runners to be successful, that feeling that I've got this, no matter what happens, I can handle it. We are naturally, our brain is responding with endogenous opioids right there. When we start experiencing pain, especially as runners or in any situation, I'm talking about as runners because that's where my research is. Mm-hmm. Right. When we're experiencing a lot of pain, which let's face it, running is painful. Our brain says, hey, I've got this. I'm going to create these endogenous opioids. I'm going to create all of these different things that in our bodies that in our brains that are going to affect our bodies and help us complete the task we want to complete. And so we know that that works. We also know that through meditation, as I was mentioning earlier, we're using other parts of our brain. So now we've got different parts of the brain, different neurotransmitters, different brain chemistry. We've got all of these things working in all different types of ways that are giving us an experience that is very unique. So because of this, they're more unique than in any other sport that I know of. Now, any endurance activity will give you a certain amount of that. But when it comes to the actual process of running, because of what it does to your body and the results in your mind and how they're working together, you are using your brain in a very different way. Now comes in my third book, which is going to be about consciousness. Mm-hmm. Your brain is a filter for consciousness. So that default mode network, and this is much more complicated than what I am saying, and I'm certainly not an expert on this, but your brain filters out consciousness. So we're aware of only 20% of the things around us mm-hmm. at best. So you have no idea what is in your line of vision right now. You're only seeing 20% of it. What else is there? And so your brain can say, oh, it's nothing. Or you can see something out of your corner of your eye like I do and say, hey, what's that? I remember one day I was sitting at my stove. I was making something. I don't remember what. And I looked over at my table, which is right across the room. And I noticed a page in my notebook was kind of floating up. And I said, wow, that's cool. Who's here? You know, just kind of, I don't know if it was real or not. I didn't see anything. I didn't feel anything, but I saw the page moving. And I said, that was so cool. Do that again. Please do it again. You know, almost being playful about it. And then it stopped. Mm-hmm. Almost in, you know, just because you recognize that and you're being playful about it, I'm not going to do it. Now, whether that's real or just my imagination, I don't know. But I will tell you that why on earth was that page floating up like that, as though it were blowing in the wind when there's no air conditioning going, there's nothing happening that could logically explain what that was. And my logical brain wants to believe in the science that exists. The rational part of me, the analytical part of me, says that everything that exists is not known. Very little of what exists is known. So why not? I'm not going to discount anything. If it seems really not real to me and in this deep sense of knowing in an intuitive way, or whatever you want to call it, then no, it's not right for me. That doesn't mean it's not right for somebody else. I don't dictate somebody else's reality mm-hmm. or somebody else's knowledge or knowing, but it's not right for me. So I think that when we are experiencing spirit, it is a deep sense of knowing what our path. It's a deep sense of knowing. I call it our dharma. I'm always encouraging people to follow their dharma, their journey, what is meant for them. The thing that brings you joy, that is what you should be doing. That is what you're meant to do. And I think that we get those signals all the time simply by feeling joy. When we feel joyful, when we feel peaceful, when we feel good about what we're doing the right things. If it's causing us pain, if it's causing us stress, if it's making us unhappy, that is not where we should be. And I think that intuitively, our soul, our spirit lets us know those things. How do you explain that? I don't know, but it's there. And I think every single one of us and all of your listeners can attest to that feeling and knowing that that feeling exists.
Mm-hmm. My goodness, there's like, I have like 100 questions from that. So what for Dharma, the thing that is your journey, I think I have a sense that there are a lot of us who spent years feeling like we're on a detour, or that the map that they gave us when we, you know, when we were in the guidance counselor's office in high school, and we followed that road, we ended up someplace we didn't want to be. So what can you do? Or I mean, what are some of the things that go along with that to kind of readjust?
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I have just been talking with a friend of mine in Colorado, of all places, who lives in the mountains, who I used to work with years ago when I worked at that university. And I said, go to the mountains by yourself. Go spend some time alone. Solitude is a gift. We're so afraid of being alone with our thoughts. We really are, because we're so used to being distracted by all of the noise in life. But you've got to get rid of that noise to get real. That's why ultra runners are closer to the answers than most people, because we spend a tremendous amount of time in solitude. Mm-hmm. Most of us do. And we go through working through the noise. And then we go through working through the self, you know, all these things that are imperfect about ourselves. So we do some self-exploration. And once we do that, we get to the really deeper, the much deeper stuff about, you know, the purpose and the meaning and what makes us happy. And this is something we do over hours and hours and hours and hours of solitude, being surrounded by a beautiful environment that encourages that. So my answer is, go run some ultras.
Yeah.
go hiking, even if you don't like running. When I go to the West a lot, I spend most of my time hiking, because let's face it, I'm a flatlander, mm-hmm. and I'm not real good in the mountains, but I will go to the point of exhaustion where I get rid of all of that stuff, all of that noise. You're physically spent, you're emotionally spent. That's where the magic is. And that's where the ultra runners find magic, right? That's where we find our spirit, our soul, our dharma. It's so clear to us in those moments. And one of the things I'm talking about, one of the mysticism criteria I'm addressing, is that reality is more real than our normal reality. We have created our realities. We can recreate them.
Yes. And kind of what you said, for somebody who's struggling, is if you're trying to look at the outside world to give you your sense of who you are, that's where some of the difficulty lies. And you talked about,
yes, absolutely,
ultra running. You kind of strip away that feeling, and you have to find those things within yourself. And so that your identity becomes something separate from what you do, what you have, and your performance in the world.
Absolutely. I mean, it's we learn who we are through others, and we grew up knowing who we are through others. So if you grew up in a toxic environment like I did, you learn some pretty awful things about yourself, and you believe those to be true. And the real problem, well, there's a lot of problems with that, but one of the problems is that you don't know who you really are. You have no concept of who you really are until you get rid of that. And I would venture to say that most people have taken on some identity that truly is not them, mm-hmm. because somebody else has told them that that's them. And so when you learn to get rid of that and you learn to cleanse yourself, you get to create yourself. Every one of us can recreate ourselves at any given moment. We have that choice. We have that option. but it's kind of overwhelming. And sometimes it can create a lot of fear because we have to leave what's known and comfortable behind and become a bigger and better version of ourselves. And some of us just aren't comfortable with that. We need some guidance. We need some encouragement. And that's a great thing about the ultra running community, particularly in the South. And I can't speak for all of them because I haven't been a part of all of them, but basically, one of my interviewees said it best, you know, the community spiritually puts you up on their shoulders and says, come on, you've got this, let's do it together, and encourages you and makes you want to be the best version of yourself. And that is very true through the sport for a lot of us. We want to be the best versions of ourselves. If we're out to prove something, that's different. We don't get the same experience and we don't have the same production of opioids, for instance. Mm-hmm. But when we are out there for other reasons, we find a lot of happiness. And it's not just that we're happy because we're letting go of the noise. Our body and our brain are helping us be happy through all of the productions of the different neurotransmitters.
Yes. And I've found that the, when I finished my first goal to run was to finish a 50 mile. And so I started running with the idea that I was going to do a 50 mile trail race a year later. And when I got finished, I got to see a friend of mine the following day. He was still working on his 100. And I saw something in his face and I went, I didn't get to that point in 50 miles. And I want to find out what that's like. And so by then I was in a community of ultra marathon runners who thought running 100 miles is totally doable. And so when I said that, they were like, sure, yeah, you can do that next year. That would be, you know, it's totally. And so that community, there's that aspect of, you know, having other people validate your identity. That is such a big deal. And if you're in a toxic environment, or if you're, you know, hanging around with people whose idea of fun is drinking till you can't see, you know, they're going to encourage you down a different path.
That is absolutely true. And, you know, I think the other part of that is that when you are surrounding yourself, particularly in environments of the outdoors, and a big part of my book is environmental psychology. There's so much science behind the consciousness of plants. Mm-hmm. When you're around other plants and animals, especially plants. I focus a lot on that because there are all kinds of things happening as plants communicate with each other, trees communicate with each other. All of that has a certain kind of consciousness, and that's not similar to a human consciousness. Mm-hmm. Even rocks have consciousness, not like humans, but they do. I prefer running in the desert, to be honest with you, because I have this, I feel so comfortable around rocks. My only point in all this is as they're communicating with each other, all of those aerosols, those hormones, they're affecting us. And there's all kinds of research to show how those are good for our well-being mentally and physically. And that's a big part of my book in talking about how that helps with depression, even clinical depression, ADHD. There are all kinds of things in there that fight cancer, all of, just by being in the woods. You're becoming mentally and physically healthier. Even if you're not running, if you're just walking, mm-hmm. you are getting those benefits just by being in nature. So all of those things are making you happy. So the whole sport and the idea of the sport and locations of the sport are supporting. And that's not even with the people. Think about all, like we were talking about with all the people in the community. You have so much supporting you, including your own mind and your own spirit, that are encouraging you to move forward. It's such a phenomenal experience. And again, unlike any other sport that I know of. Mm-hmm.
So you brought up consciousness and you know, rocks and trees, but there's also a human consciousness. And I know neuroscience is, there's a lot of debate about what exactly that is and where it comes from. But so can you speak a little bit to what's the role of consciousness in relationship to the body and mind?
Wow. Okay. So one of the classes I took in graduate school in analytic philosophy, and I'm finishing graduate school now. I have all my classes finished, and this book was my thesis.
Okay.
But I got all excited about the science, and so I said I'll finish the philosophy parts later. There is philosophy in it, but I just was so excited about the science. So panpsychism, the idea that everything basically has consciousness, mm-hmm. and My personal beliefs have no scientific backing that I know of.
Okay.
This is something I'm writing my second, third book about. I've written a couple books that I have not published, but there's another one I'm on the project, the back burner after this book. And that has to do with the idea that consciousness is all around us. It's kind of like we are energy. There's energy around us. We can manipulate energy with our thoughts. Mm-hmm. We can manipulate energy through our movements. There's all kinds of ways that we affect energy as we move through life. So you've heard of the power of prayer. Everybody's heard of the power of prayer. There's science behind that. Sending people positive energy. There's science behind that. It literally does impact them. You know, the whole idea of manifestation, and that is absolutely true. You're creating energy, whether it's positive or negative, constantly. So are people around you. That is why it's so important to surround yourself with positive people who encourage you to be the best you can, rather than criticize or downplay the beautiful person that you truly are. And so a part of that consciousness and a part of that soul or spirit is very collective. Part of it is within us. Part of it is outside of us. It's connecting other people. Other people are tapping into it. I think that it's just all energy, to be honest with you. Now, if you ask me to explain energy in such a way that it makes sense, I am nowhere near being to that point. But what I can tell you is that we have such strong impacts on each other. Any one of your listeners will know. If you walk up to a person and you don't know this person from anyone else, you will immediately feel good, bad, or indifferent, mm-hmm. right? You get a sense of a person before they speak, before you know who they are. You're feeling their energy, right? You're feeling their attitude. You're feeling whatever. And we do. Empaths are particularly sensitive to that kind of energy. And so we take on other people's energy so quickly, which is why I will not allow toxic people around me at all, which is kind of hard when I do what I do. But I'm good at putting up barriers when I'm at work, but I'm exhausted at the end of the day and I need my meditation and I need my good stuff. But anyway, I think that we all have that ability. And I think that we all perceive it. We just don't pay attention to it as much. And I think that if we paid more attention to things like that, we would have a greater sense of it. If you walk away from a job interview and you're like, wow, that was amazing, there's something wonderful in that for you. It may not be that particular job, but maybe it is in that type of position, or maybe that's your journey, or maybe you connected with that person. You know, that's worth some exploration rather than, and some critical thinking, rather than just writing it off as being one thing. So I can't always define exactly what it is, but I know what those feelings are. And when I feel them, I pay attention to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this has been a topic that I've been interested in as well. And the idea of consciousness, and I relate it to, you know, the Christian faith of, you know, mind, body, and spirit, soul, body, and spirit. And, you know, in the Christian tradition, they talk about soul and spirit almost interchangeably, but sometimes they talk about it separately. And so that's been something that I've it's been a topic that I've thought about, is what is the difference between what to consider mind and consciousness? And you kind of said that it's all energy. And that's interesting. So is there a way to make the best use of that energy, and what are some of the things that ultra runners can do, and to maybe experience some of the mysticism?
I think one thing we have to realize, and this is my next book, is that we are the creators of our reality. You know, the choices that we make inevitably affect the way we feel about ourselves. And when we make choices that are good for us, we have a tendency to feel better about that and feel better about ourselves. And then we're empowered to make more good choices, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not talking about addiction, or I'm not talking about things that make us feel good that are not good for us, because that's a whole different topic. What I am talking about is things that you feel deep and intuitively that are in your best interest. Stop and think about what really makes you happy. If you don't know that, you've got to clear all that stuff out of your head, all of that noise, and get away from it. You know, like I said before, practice some solitude, get caught up in the moment of being in the outdoors rather than contemplating your to-do list, right? And sometimes you have to spend a lot of time outside to do that. The whole idea of ultra running, for instance, is not new. All kinds of cultures for thousands of years have been using endurance, hiking, walking, and running as pathways to enlightenment. The whole first chapter of my book is about that. I have an interview, fingers crossed, with a runner that they celebrate running in attaining enlightenment in various Native American cultures. And I should be interviewing a Native American about a feast day. It's very sacred, and there are a lot of things that they cannot discuss, mm-hmm. but I hope to get some information from them, because we're talking about monks in Japan. We're talking about monks in Tibet. We're talking about ancient Greece. We're talking about every culture in almost every culture that I know of for hundreds of thousands of years have been using endurance sports as a type of vision quest, as a type of attaining enlightenment. So there is some precedence, a lot of precedence for mind-body-spirit connection. And I think that when you have those three in balance, and you can call spirit soul, that's a Christian thing mm-hmm. primarily. And I'm not necessarily a Christian. I wasn't raised with any religion, so I never really went on that journey. So for me, it's spirit, right? And so for me, the spirit, the mind, body, and spirit is something for me that needs to be in constant balance for me to feel whole. That may not always be the case for everyone, but I suspect it probably is. Because when we are physically healthy and our bodies are moving, that's part of who we are. I have a whole chapter about how we were born to run based on our physicality and our evolution, et cetera. But nonetheless, I think that with a mind-body-spirit connection and keeping those as imbalanced as possible is going to create a more whole experience, a more unified experience of who we are as a mind, body, and spirit. Because I think they all work together. And when we satisfy all three of those, we're whole.
Yes. Yeah. Well, tell us about your book. I know it's in process. How will, if somebody hears this and says, hey, you know, I want to find out more about this when it comes out, how's the best way for them to connect with you to find out more?
Well, now, first of all, so anybody's welcome to contact me through my email, which is Gwendolyn Lee, GWENDOLYN is my first name, LEIGH is my middle name at Yahoo. And I'm happy to talk with anybody about any of this. But I will say that overall, this book, it sets precedence that ultra running or walking or hiking or anything is what has always been a pathway to attain enlightenment, like a vision quest. Mm-hmm. I'm also talking about mysticism and criteria that has been basically goes all the way back to the beginnings of written record, both in religions and in philosophy, and how mysticism is defined through those criteria that had been discovered many, 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 many years ago. Mm-hmm. I'm also talking, like I said, about how we are physically born to run, because we're the only mammals with a gluteus maximus. We're the only mammals with an Achilles tendon. We are the only ones who choose to run long distances and who find pleasure in it. Is that an accident? Well, some people say it is, and some people say no. But nonetheless, physically, our hunter-gatherer selves felt most at peace when we were constantly engaging in communication with our environments, not preoccupied with our phones. That has taken us away from who we really are and has led to a lot of unhappiness. So we get involved with electronics, we get involved with our day-to-day tasks, and rather than moving and experiencing these signals from our environment, we are completely oblivious to them because there's just too much concrete and there's too much electricity. Yeah. And so that takes us away from who we truly are as humans. And then I go into the mind and the mental toughness and all of the things that are involved with that. There's a wonderful book by Matt Fitzgerald called How Bad Do You Want It? And I refer to his work quite a bit. I talk about the physical part. A colleague of mine at LSU is an expert in DMT research, and our production of DMT, along with other endogenous opioids that help create this experience that we're having, which some could call kind of psychedelic, and in some ways it might be, but we naturally produce this in our bodies anyway. It's just kind of overproduced when we are in the process of ultra running. I also talk about the spirit and how we're using other parts of our brain, the studies that have been done with nons and monks and how Buddhists meditation, how that affects other parts of our brain. And then, of course, I'm incorporating other experiences, as you know, Eric, because I just interviewed you for the book as well. So I'm putting in a lot of talking about this in a more very academic way and making it as accessible as I can. Let me just put in a little air quote here and saying, I am not an expert. I spent all day today learning about endogenous opioids that I already thought I had a pretty good handle on. And once I did some more research, I realized I need to learn more.
Clarify, what is endogenous opioids? I think I know what you mean, but
they are naturally produced.
Your body produces.
Correct. Yes. So we are producing all kinds of things.
Yes.
We produce cortisol when we are stressed, right? We already know about cortisol, for instance. We produce all sorts of things that are just not only affecting different parts of our brain, but different parts of our body in ways that nobody really understands. We are just getting to points where we're starting to understand some connections. It's just so complex. And so a lot of the research I'm reading, fortunately, I have access to because I'm a faculty member and a graduate student at LSU. I have to spend the entire day looking up terms because I really don't know what it means. Mm-hmm. And that's what I spent today doing. So it's one of those true investments that pays off when I get that kind of understanding, at least on a very minimal scale. And I want to share that with readers. And I will cite my sources, and I will have a reference page, several reference pages. So if they want to learn more, they can access that material for themselves. But nonetheless, I think that it's really important for myself, because I did not grow up with the same faith as a lot of people did. For me, I need some science and I need some experiences as well. I don't discount either one. I find them both equally as important because we have experiences that cannot be explained by science. And I know that, and I validate it, and I value it. So that is a part of it as well. It just is very fascinating to me how so much of the experiences people are having as they share them with me, not knowing about the philosophy or about the science, actually is working completely in tandem with what I've been learning. Mm-hmm. So that is the really beautiful thing. And that is the exciting part of this whole book for me.
That's great. So what is the name of the book?
I have a working title of Ultra Running Mysticism, Mind, Body, Spirit, and the Sacredness of Overcoming Suffering.
Okay. So, and do you have a planned publish date? You're just doing research right now, so
I'm every time I think I'm getting closer, I find out that there's more I don't know that I need to get in there.
That's the problem with research.
I'm hoping to just say, okay, anything I don't discover by next summer, too late. My book is going to be published next summer. And I really do hope that I get all the editing done by then. This started off as an academic paper, and I want it to be much more accessible than what parts of it are. And so I'm going to go back and make sure that after I've written all of it, that is everything is very accessible and it flows very, very well. And that interviews are tied in very logical and smooth flowing places so that it is enjoyable, because I don't want it to just be academic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you'll find that the editing process is very similar to running an ultramarathon.
I am finding that. I found that with my last book as well. But I do think that once I have all the ideas there and in place, at least that will feel like a relief.
Yeah. I wrote a book, and the editing process was it was before I was a runner, but it was a very very long and arduous.
That's why everybody, a friend of mine put on Facebook, oh, you're in the final stages of writing, so you'll be published sooner. No. Editing is probably going to take just as long as the writing.
Yeah.
And I know that. So, but like an ultra runner, my mindset is always, oh, I'm almost done, because I keep that excitement going, right? I don't ever say, oh, I have so much to do, because that changes everything.
Yeah. You never think about the entire race. You just think about how far to your next checkpoint, your next aid station.
Exactly.
When can I eat again?
Exactly. And so that's best for me. So when I get this chapter on endogenous opioids and all that mostly done, I'm happy. Yeah, I'm so happy.
Yeah, you celebrate that and set your next goal. Yeah,
life is too short not to celebrate everything.
That's great. Well, I hope that people who listen to this, I'll put the name in the show notes and email. So, are you active? You're active on Facebook as well. Can people connect you there?
I am, and Instagram. I don't really post that much. It depends on the day and how busy I am. But I definitely am on Facebook.
Okay,
looking to make new runner friends or friends who want to be runners. People who are just interested in running. Yeah. It doesn't matter. Yeah.
Yeah. I do that too. It's like, I look at the profile and go, oh yeah, they're a runner. I'll reach out to them. So
I like to share other people's journeys with them, even if it's just social media. I know there's a lot of downfalls of social media. I truly understand that, but I focus on the benefits. I want to know what my friends are doing with their running and racing. I love that I posted, I'm doing a 50 mile this Saturday in New Orleans. And I love the fact that when I just say I'm excited about it, I have so many friends. Good luck. Oh, I'm excited for you. You know, those little things mean so, so, so much. And I remember those things, and it helps add to the experience. And I love to do that for others as well. In fact, I feel really badly if I miss one because I haven't been on Facebook for a few days because I've been just wrapped up in writing or something. But I think that part of the community is amazing. And I love doing that for others as well.
Yeah. And that's kind of what we talked about, the community support. And so you get that can come even through Facebook or Instagram.
Oh, absolutely. And, yes.
That's been great. And, keeping that, keeping the social media from overtaking your life is part of that mental discipline, that mental, keeping yourself focused and not get sucked into to being drugged down or drug away.
I'm pretty good at that, actually, Eric. What I do every day at about 5 o'clock is I turn everything off. My friends know they cannot contact me. They're not going to hear from me until the next day. And it's very important. That's my spirit time. Mm-hmm. I spend my day, I run in the mornings, I do strength training during the day, I work, I write, but I turn it off at a certain time of the day and I'm done with it. And the rest of that time is for reading, pleasurably, not my research stuff, which is pleasurable, but in its own way.
Right.
Or meditating or doing yoga or whatever. That is my spirit time. And I have only violated that a few times in the past year, because it's very important to me, because that keeps me whole. Mm-hmm. And that keeps me in the balance that I talked about earlier. And I think we all should do that, to be honest.
Well, yes. And I think that probably impacts, you could testify that impacts your running as well. I mean, overall, because if you don't have that type of feeding yourself emotionally, spiritually, it does affect you, affects your physical body as well.
Absolutely. Self-care is the most important care.
Yeah. Well, thank you a lot, Gwen. I appreciate the time. This has been great. And hopefully we will, I will look forward to seeing your book. It sounds like something I would love to read.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And I appreciate all of your thoughts, and I appreciate you being a part of the book and having me on your podcast. I have really enjoyed that. I love talking about these things. So we're very like-minded, and I really do appreciate the chance to share our ideas together.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of the Ultramarathon Mindset Podcast. If you would like to get a copy of Gwen's book, Ultra Running Mysticism, Mind, Body, Spirit, and the Sacredness of Overcoming Suffering, you can buy it now on Amazon. In fact, it just came out as of yesterday from when this podcast is going to be released. And if you're hearing this, you can go to Amazon and look it up, Ultra Running Mysticism, Mind, Body, Spirit, and the Sacredness of Overcoming Suffering, by Gwen Zwicky. Her last name is spelled Zywicke. And also, I will have a link to that in the show notes. And speaking of show notes, You can find those at ultramindsetpodcast.run. The show notes for this episode and all the other episodes as well. There's also a place if you would like to talk back and give me your opinion on anything or any stories that you have about running. We'd be glad to have that. There is a place there that you can click and leave comments, questions, and stories. There's some in the sidebar and also at the top of at the top of all of the page where the show notes are. If you did enjoy this episode, if you know somebody who might like to experience mystical experiences and have a try at what we've talked about, send them a link to this episode. We'd appreciate having you share it. Remember, an ultramarathon mindset is about more than just running. If you're stuck, if you would like to find out what you can accomplish in life, what you can do to go find your epic thing in running or in life, I'm a life coach. Send me a message. You can do it through the website, ultramindsetpodcast.run, or you can hit me up on Instagram. That is kind of my social media of choice. It's at Eric Dieter, E-R-I-C-D-E-E-T-E-R. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time.